Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. My name is Steve Diamond, and I'm here to introduce our show today, October 22nd, 2005. Thanks for joining us. Today we'll be taking a closer look at democracy and nationalism in the Middle East and beyond. We'll start by hearing from Azmi Bashara, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, speaking on war, racism, and the American strategy in the Middle East. We'll then hear from Mindwalk 17, a collage of recent indie media radio content. And of course, political music. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, who spoke recently in Seattle, followed by Between the Lines. First, some news. Israel plans West Bank apartheid roads, from Al Jazeera. Israel is considering a permanent ban on Palestinians using major roads in the occupied West Bank, security sources have said, drawing Palestinian condemnation of the idea as a form of apartheid. Israel barred private Palestinian vehicles from several West Bank highways on Monday, expanding a network of settler-only routes, a day after Palestinian fighters killed three young Jewish settlers in a drive-by shooting. The army had billed the new restrictions as temporary to protect Israelis from further attack, but a plan is now under consideration for permanently designating some roads for separate use by Israelis and Palestinians. Israel's Ma'ariv Daily said it was part of a larger blueprint to eventually separate the Israeli and Palestinian populations. Palestinians see the measure, which forces them onto poorly maintained backroads, as part of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's strategy of tightening Israel's grip on West Bank settlement blocks after pulling all 8,500 settlers out of the Gaza Strip. In White House talks on Thursday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is expected to urge pressure for a halt to Israeli settlement construction in the West Bank. Palestinians want Gaza and the West Bank for a future state. Palestinian chief negotiator Saeb Erekat said, "If they go ahead and make the road restrictions permanent, it is the official introduction of an apartheid system. This scheme would destroy any effort to revive a meaningful peace process." He said creation of separate roads also bolsters Israel's barrier under construction in the West Bank. Abbas's advisor Jabril al-Rajoub said, "The achievement of security is based on ending the occupation and pulling out of the Palestinian territories to the 1967 borderline." And from the Associated Press, Rice won't rule out troops in Iraq in 10 years. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on Wednesday refused to rule out U.S. troops still being in Iraq in 10 years or the possibility that the United States could use military force against neighboring Syria and Iran. Rice deferred to the decisions of President Bush and military commanders as Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee pressed her for more specifics on the U.S. strategy in Iraq. Lawmakers also pressed her on how the U.S. will deal with Iran and Syria. Rice said the United States was using diplomatic means to urge a change in the behavior of both countries, but she stopped short of ruling out military force. She said, "I'm not going to get into what the President's options might be. I don't think the President ever takes any of his options off the table concerning anything to do with military force." Testifying before the committee for the first time since February, Rice sought to reassure jittery members of Congress that the Bush administration had a plan for success, helping Iraqis clear out insurgents and build durable national institutions. She told lawmakers the United States would follow a model that was successful in Afghanistan. Starting next month, she said, joint diplomatic military groups, provincial reconstruction teams, will work alongside Iraqis as they train police, set up courts, and help local governments establish essential services. But even as Rice tried to crystallize the plan, Republicans and Democrats asked her pointed questions they say Americans need to know. Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, the top Democrat on the panel, said, "I'm not looking for a date to get out of Iraq, but at what point, assuming the strategy works, do you think we'll be able to see some sign of bringing some American forces home?" Rice declined to answer directly, choosing to leave an estimate to military commanders. She said, "I don't want to hazard what I think would be a guess, even if it were an assessment of when that might be possible," she said. The lawmakers' queries followed Rice's earlier remarks that, quote, "Syria and indeed Iran must decide whether they wish to side with the cause of war or with the cause of peace." As Rice spoke, a woman in the second row of spectators shouted, "Stop the killing in Iraq!" A police officer motioned her out of the room. With President Bush's poll numbers dragged down by public discomfort over Iraq, Rice was seeking to reassure lawmakers who are feeling the heat from their war-weary constituents that U.S. policies towards Iraq are sound. Since Condoleezza Rice told lawmakers the United States would follow in Iraq a model that was successful in Afghanistan, appropriately enough, our next story is about Afghanistan. From the Associated Press, former governor who oversaw destruction of ancient Buddhas is elected to Afghan parliament. A former regional governor who oversaw the destruction of two giant 1,500-year-old Buddha statues during the Taliban's reign has been elected to parliament, election organizers announced Tuesday as the results from two provinces were finalized. In the latest fighting, meanwhile, U.S.-led coalition forces killed four police after mistaking them for militants during an operation in southern Afghanistan, a top government official said Tuesday. The coalition said it could not confirm the incident and was investigating. The Taliban disregarded worldwide protests in March 2001 and used dynamite and artillery to blow up the 5th-century Buddha statues, famed for their size and located along the ancient Silk Road linking Europe and Central Asia. The Taliban considered them idolatrous and anti-Muslim. At the time, Malawi Muhammad Islam Muhammadi was the Taliban's governor of Bamiyan province, where the statues are located. After U.S.-led forces ousted the fundamentalist regime in late 2001, he fled to the country's north and was never detained, unlike other Taliban officials. On September 18th, he stood as an election candidate in neighboring Samagan province and won, according to results on the website of the UN Afghan election organizers. Election law didn't bar former Taliban officials from taking part in the race. Speaking to the Associated Press, Muhammadi said he should not be held responsible for the Buddha's destruction. "It was not my decision. It was foreigners like Chechens and Arabs with the Taliban who made the decision. They were crazy people," he said in a telephone interview. "Even though I was governor, I had no power." Though provincial results have been published for several regions, only four provinces have been finalized, including Samagan and nearby Kapisa province Tuesday. Also declared winners in those areas were three former warlords who are suspected still to have ties with armed groups. Human rights officials say that at least half of the winners are regional strongmen linked to armed groups, raising fears of more violence. In the latest bloodshed to rack the country, U.S.-led coalition troops opened fire at police in Kandahar province's Maywand district late Monday after spotting the officers firing their weapons into the air and mistaking them for Taliban rebels, the governor of Kandahar said. Meanwhile, a bomb exploded on a main road in the south and killed an Afghan guard working for an American security company and wounding two others. Fighting has escalated in Afghanistan in the past half year, leaving more than 1,400 people dead and raising fears for the country's nascent democracy.
Shot, do we want a war? Anybody listening? Haven't we learned anything? What's the point of killing when it hasn't worked before? Before the final culture clash, before this fragile piece is smashed, before we all do something rash, back it up. Situation simmer, nothing to consider. Implications of a war, nobody will win. Fundamental chaos, fighting for the right to use God's name and everything related to the cause. Everybody, everybody breathe. Everybody, everybody believe. Before we step right off the edge, before we are at war, is it? Before we start to count the dead, back it up.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
We elect the ones who choose how many they're prepared to lose. Put in power, supposedly, to rescue us from death's decree.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
Theological debate collapses into racial hate. Faith has made us dumb and blind to the future of mankind. We all breathe, we all bleed, we all share the basic need. Draft by color, place of birth, you're on this team, so pray it works.
Everybody breathe.
future of mankind.
Everybody breathe.
Ask not everybody what
breathe.
Your country can do for you.
Everybody breathe.
Ask what you can do for
everybody
your country.
Watch the camera on the world, keeping you and me involved, being fed what to believe, with no control of what we see.
Everybody breathes.
That was James Blundell with Back It Up. Next, we have excerpts from a talk with Azmi Bishara, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, speaking on war, racism, and American strategy in the Middle East.
Concerning justice and democracy, historical context is here very important. Democracies, especially in the case of the United States, Australia, were built on injustices. We are speaking about genocides. In this case, not just injustices is a modest word for genocide. In the context of the discourse which was prevailing at that time, what is a human being? Certain people were not considered even human being. And the terms of the framework for the functioning of democracy and justice in it is for what a certain civilization at that time, or certain culture or hegemonial discourse considered human being. Now, of course, these are sources of huge historical deficiencies that democracy will carry to the end of times. It won't get rid of this. But the historical fact is that no human discourse today put other humans outside the category of human beings. So you can't today say, I am for justice, but not for the Palestinians. You can't anymore say, you can think, but you can't say, and this is very important, that this, I do believe that hypocrisy is much easier than fascism, unlike radicals who think that the most dangerous thing is hypocrisy. I think hypocrisy sometimes is great, that people don't say what they think, because I think it's very dangerous when you go around saying that justice is okay, but not for the Palestinians. No, I want you to say justice and for the Palestinians so they can have a dialogue with you. You're outside the dialogue circle. So in our world today, you can't say anymore justice, but for these races, no, because they are not considered human beings for me. Now, in the framework of what they thought is a human being, they did think of just and fair, and they believed in what they think. In that sense, these races, in the relationship, not only to the native people, but also to women, in the relationship to women, in the relationship to people with another color, they believed that they are outside the circle of thinking about justice at all. I think a real shift happened in the 20th century after two world wars, that in the hegemonial discourses that we have in our world, nobody can see this or use this anymore, and I want to take advantage of this. So this is a revolutionary change in history, that today you can't say, I want to make a democracy in Algeria, for example, but only for the educated male Algerians who finished their graduate school at least. And the rest will not have voting rights. You could say that in the 19th century. And you could speak in terms of justice and democracy like this. Today you can't say it and be just. The weak and the oppressed in the world can take advantage of it. In that sense, a huge change happened in the Western civilization that we underestimate. Because of our critical edge, because of the injustices that are still there. But the fact that the issue of justice is so universal on the level of discourse, this is a revolutionary change. It needed many world wars, a lot of genocides until we reached this. If you really want to live in a democratic system, your struggle is not finished by 40% of the society going to the ballots every 4 years. I mean different things totally when I speak about democracy. I speak about participation, social conditions that enable you to participate, which means social rights. My understanding of liberal democracy is totally opposed to neoliberal approach, which is now the new enemy inside democracy, not the fundamentalisms, but a tendency which is ready to move the democratic society without 30% of the society. Homeless, poor, outside the circulation, outside the market, unable to consume even, etc. And I don't know if you follow, but actually what we get in the third world in the form of export schools of democracy usually come from the neoliberals, and their allies in the Middle East are usually the neoliberals. If you take the Arab regimes now, the people who are the best partners and the most sincere partners of this tendency of the new cons are the neoliberals of the Arab world, who are ready really for prophets to walk on bodies, on dead bodies. And many of them are the second generation of the same ruling elites in the Arab world, mostly sons of kings and presidents, etc., who are now being qualified to rule, in most cases, from dictatorships and undemocratic kingdoms and sheikhdoms, etc., who carry now from the West neoliberal thoughts and ready to work with the new kinds in certain reforms, but in certain limits that can keep the political power and the economic power in the country. So I think that these are the coming problem in the so-called export of democracy in the Arab world, these people.
Would you support the American withdrawal from Iraq today? And if so, what would be a viable alternative to prevent the whole country from disintegrating?
Concerning the disintegration and the withdrawal of the United States from Iraq, of course, I don't even accept the idea that now they cannot withdraw because of all the mess that they made, they can't now withdraw. I don't accept that because I think the longer they stay, the mess will deepen. It will be even worse. One of the major arguments which is said in the Israeli and the American university, but usually I heard it in the Israeli universities before, is the idea that there was never an Arab nation, an Arab nationality, as if there was always a Jewish nationality. And we have to accept that, you know, that the Arabs are not a nationality, but Jewishness is. And suddenly, you become unhistoric. Suddenly, you become very ideological. Suddenly, mysticism dominates in the academic discourse, forgetting that nations and nationalities are in general modern phenomena, and that nations and nationalities are produced, are constructed. They are made, they are man-made phenomena. And usually they were made after the 17th century. This is in the early nations, the so-called normal early nationalities which had normal path of development, which is the early capitalist societies that started with the absolute monarchies. And that there are late nations, like the German one, like the Italian one, they are also made by very strong unification movement with a lot of bloodshed. From 300 states, you make one state. You produce nationalities. And Arab nationality is also produced, like the rest, like the French. It was also produced with a lot of bloodshed against the Bretons. And like lately, Zionism tried to turn the Jewish religious diaspora of holy communities that, well, it's an ancient people. Of course, it's an ancient people. But all peoples were religions. All religions were people once in the antique. In that sense, the Jews were not an exception. But then the tendency to retroactively impose nationalism on Jewish history, as if all nations are modern, except the Jews, they were always a nation. They were a people like all the people. Yes, they were a people, not just a religion. But no religion was just a religion. Every religion was a people once. Now, the fact that you nationalized this sacred community, you needed a secular national movement to do it. It's called Zionism. And it was not produced in Palestine, but in Europe. And the Arab nationalism went to the same schools like Zionism, which is European nationalism. But the endeavors, the efforts, the huge efforts, cultural, political, etc., of Arab nationalism were defeated by British and French interests in the region in coalition, in very strong alignments with traditional pre-national leaderships, tribal usually, against secular nationalism. Since that time, Western colonialism in the region was against progress. was usually a lie of traditional pre-modern forces against modernist forces. This is the situation. It is very deep. It is too deep for people who hold these ideas to claim that they are for democracy in the Middle East. Nobody will believe them. Nobody. Their history with reactionary Arab movements and conservative and authenticity and tradition and religion is too long to be believed that they are suddenly Democrats now. Khalas, huh? Enough. We can't solve the whole region's problems today.
That was Azmi Bishara, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset. Next, we have excerpts from Mind Walk 17.
Welcome to Mind Walk, produced at Upstart Radio for Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Radio Free Moscow, IndieMedia.org, RadioForAll.net, community and micropower stations worldwide.
The U.S. wants to develop a new type of nuclear weapon, a nuclear earth penetrator or bunker buster. This nuclear bomb, intended to destroy underground targets, would be useless against many bunkers. At the same time, it would produce massive amounts of radioactive fallout and potentially kill millions of civilians.
That is a significant contribution.
A few meters into the ground, too shallow to contain the nuclear blast or the large cloud of radioactive fallout.
What does that mean exactly, Mr. President?
First of all, I don't know. It's all speculation at this point, and you're welcome to clarify what you just said if you feel like it.
The nuclear radiation could spread more than 1,000 miles.
Isn't that what you said?
Over 3 million people would be killed as a result of the attack.
I understand that. I mean, you know, I can figure it out.
And 35 million people would be exposed to significant cancer-causing radiation.
That shouldn't concern the United States. And I just hope everything would be okay. How to react? Okay. And how to react? Okay. How to react? Okay. And what dialogue? How to react? Okay. And how to react? Okay. How to react? Okay. And what dialogue?
If the United States used a single weapon with a 1 megaton yield against the Isfahan nuclear facility in Iran, the deadly radioactive fallout would spread to Pakistan,
and
Afghanistan, and India.
Every contribution matters. I am grateful. Concern.
To destroy buried targets, the seismic shock wave produced by the bomb would need to reach the bunker. However, a 1 megaton nuclear bomb could only destroy bunkers within about 1,000 feet of the explosion, and the United States is unlikely to know the exact location of bunkers, even if it knows the entry points.
It's a strong statement.
A nuclear weapon would also be ineffective at sterilizing underground stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons unless it detonates very close to the target. This is because the heat and radiation from a nuclear explosion do not travel far underground.
The key now is to put that behind us. Now, we didn't discuss the issue at NATO, by the way.
The White House says the idea was to highlight an important milestone in Iraq, Saturday's referendum on the proposed constitution, and thank the troops for their sacrifice.
The Regierung der nationalen Erhebung ist entschlossen, ihre vor dem deutschen Volk übernommene Aufgabe zu erfüllen. Sie tritt daher heute hin vor dem deutschen Reichstag mit dem heißen Wunsch, in ihm eine Stütze zu finden für die Durchführung ihrer Mission.
Speaking to soldiers in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, the president used the video conference to repeat his arguments for staying in Iraq.
Es geht dabei nicht nur um das negative Problem der Bekämpfung dieser Lehre und ihrer Organisation handelt, sondern um die Durchführung der positiven Aufgabe der Gewinnung des deutschen Arbeiters für den Nationalstaat.
This isn't the first time this administration used troops to help sell the Iraq war. In fact, the Bush White House has choreographed everything from town hall meetings on Social Security to campaign events with planted questions. Many administrations, Democrat and Republican, stage manage events, and often the news media ignore the choreography. David Gergen worked for four presidents, including three Republicans.
I've rarely seen the news staged with the military in quite as blatant a way, but it has been done before, so it does belong to a long and somewhat unhappy tradition.
I think there's an important connection, you know, between truth and democracy. You can't really think of your country as a democracy if people don't know the truth. And what we are misinformed about is not just the present, but the past. And that is especially important, because if you're lied to about the past, you're not really in a position to judge what you are told about the present. Then, and anybody in authority can get up in front of the microphone and tell you that we must go to war for this reason or that reason.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
And if you don't know any history, if you don't know anything about our past, you have no basis for challenging what you are being told. So we call ourselves a democracy, and we, you know, like to think that it's very simple. And there are the bad states and there are the good states, and we're the good state. And, you know, that kind of sort of Manichaean division of the world into democracies and not democracies is very, very dangerous, because then those countries which are designated as democracies think that they have a blank check to do whatever they want in the world and it'll be okay.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
But, you know, we're beginning to suspect, you know, that's not exactly okay. Things like the First Amendment may just as well not exist. And it's interesting, we all grow up sort of priding ourselves on the fact that we have a First Amendment. And that's what, you know, that's what our country is known for, freedom of speech and press and so on. But when wartime comes, you can't. You can't have freedom of speech. So the result is that the First Amendment is most operative in times of peace. It's not very operative, but it's most operative. In times of war, it is least operative. In other words, the First Amendment is least operative when it's most needed.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
People would have been aware if they only knew some history. And if you knew some history, you would not be prone to the notion that the United States is somehow an exception in the world.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
This notion of American exceptionalism is something that is so strong in our culture, in our education, that it constitutes sort of a fundamental lie that protects the actions of any administration from really, you know, close scrutiny. When the government is in control of the media, and when the media, in its cowardly way, goes along with the government and agrees and approves of everything that the government does, And then whatever common sense people have is somehow pushed to the side and is taken over by this kind of hysteria about terrorism, and therefore, well, anything we do that the president says against terrorism, I guess, is the right thing to do. But I think what is happening now is that more and more people are thinking about that, and more and more people are thinking, well, are we safer now as a result of two wars? Are we safer now that we've killed more people in Afghanistan than died in the Twin Towers? Are we safer now that we have driven hundreds of thousands of people in Afghanistan out of their homes as a result of our bombing? And that the Taliban, which we paraded as the reason we got rid of the Taliban, is still around in Afghanistan and controls a good part of the country. It seems we are creating more terrorists by what we're doing. You know, the idea of a war on terrorism is, of course, self-contradictory. I mean, aside from the fact that a war on terrorism breeds more terrorists, war itself is terrorism. I mean, that's what war is. War, I mean, what is, you know, when you start a massive air attack on the cities of a country, and you say we're engaging in a campaign of shock and awe, that you're describing terrorism. There's an Italian surgeon named Gino Strada. I don't know if you've heard, any of you have heard of him. He's very famous in Italy. He's a man who for the last 10 or 15 years has been going around to all the war-torn areas of the world operating on victims of war. And so he not only is trying to expand his program and get more and more medical centers and emergency centers, but no, he wants to start a campaign, not against this war or that war, but against war, you see, which sounds, you know, it sounds utopian, but the abolition of slavery in the 1830s sounded utopian. Unless you start to think in a utopian way, unless you set goals which seem unreachable, you will never reach them. At any point, you see. Now, as I said, there are a lot of good people around everywhere and here and all over the country. And so long as everybody does a little bit, you have to do something. Yeah, really, you have to do something. Even if it's a little bit. But when lots and lots of people do little bits of things, at certain points in history, they come together and something good happens. Thank you.
Italy, Paris, France, in dozens of cities in Spain, reports in Athens, Georgia, in Austin, Texas, Blacksburg, Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina, Colorado Springs, and Defiance, Ohio, Denver, Colorado, as well as Durango, Geneva, New York, and Houston, Texas, Hyannis, Massachusetts, in Hawaii as well, Lawrence, Kansas, Los Angeles, California, and I am only naming a few.
Our life spread. This fight's led to the same thing that my stripes led. This movement for justice as it's rocket as it's widespread. Sanctions to occupation, globalization, no organization, or anti-death penalty mobilizations. We come correct in every situation, supporting workers striking to improve conditions at the occupation. We come on better with each and every endeavor to be free from the fetter of a life pursuing the cheddar. Who could bet I say it's clever with the leather, regardless of weather, forever touching that organ that's under your sweater. They say get back, we say fight back. We wouldn't take it if they did us like they did Iraq. They say get back, we say fight back. We wouldn't take it if they did us like they did Iraq. They say get back, we say fight back. We wouldn't take it if they did us like they did Iraq. They say get back.
This has been Mind Walk, an Upstart Radio production for nonprofit use.
You look like you're just the ripe age to be drafted. Which would you rather sacrifice, your hot car or your life? Die for oil, sucker.
He said we're headed for war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
Born on the firecracker 4th of July, raised on football and MTV. Never felt what it's like to have to fight to stay free. Vietnam, just a Time Life book memory. The mask is off again, this time nobody cares, but you can't keep dancing when your legs are blown away. Die for oil, sucker. Hello, Jim! You too can get your face shot off, so arms race tycoons won't have to get a real job. The Cold War's over, it was all a mirage. We could use that money, we got problems to solve. But we're not allowed a chance at the peace dividend, cause our psycho president's got his head in the sand. What kind of a Bush League double cross is this? Cheap oil? The price has already gone up. Die for oil, sucker. Sucker. Hello, Jim!
It's the ultimate rush. Because you know you're going into the fight to begin with. And then you got a good song playing in the background. That gets you real fired up. Ready to do the job.
You too can get your spinal cord snapped to save greedy kings from the greed of Iraq. And they're sitting on something we can learn to live without. But certain fat cats' bank accounts cannot. Oil. Die for oil, sucker. For this, you get to be all you can be. A dead Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. Hello, Jeff!
Win the hearts and minds of the people. That's our job. We have to bring the ideal of democracy and freedom to the country.
Once we take over that place, we'll never be able to leave. Somehow we think we're gonna waltz right in to colonize their hearts and minds. But the Arab people are now so damn mad, we'll be lucky to get out of there alive.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Bring them on.
Because America the Beautiful is going to hell. We no longer make cars or TVs very well. Our economy's rigged on selling guns and making war. What happens when no one wants our products anymore? America the Powerful has hit a decline. Our cities and our people are falling apart. Got one thing left to sell, that's the world police. A mercenary state to ensure there's no peace.
In the fields of bodies burning. Bring them on. As the war machine keeps turning. Bring them on. Bring them on. Poisoning their brainwashed mind. Bring them on.
I'm a war president. I make decisions here in the Oval Office and form policy matters with war on my mind.
It's about the 23 million people of Iraq and bringing them freedom. And that's what we're really here to do.
The targeting capabilities and the care that goes into targeting is as impressive as anything anyone could see.
Got him. Good. Second one. Hit the other one.
This was a lot more real and true than just a video game. A lot of people thought it was just me. Oh, yeah, look through the sight and shoot. No. A lot of this is face-to-face, and especially riding by after some of the bombs have went off and seeing all the people on the side of the road bloated up and just all the smells around you. I mean, from the people lying dead, rotted, and it's a lot more gruesome than you think. with some artillery and some napalm and things like that. Some innocent women and children got hit. We met them on the road, and they had little girls with noses blowing off and like husbands carrying their dead wives and things like that. That was extremely difficult to deal with because you're like, shoot, what the hell do we do now?
The care that goes into it, the humanity that goes into it.
For oil. Don't be a sucker.
That was a Skidmark Bob remix of Jello Biafra, Die for Oil. Next we have What They Don't Tell You by Jody Paulson.
Hi, I'm Jody Paulson with What They Don't Tell You. On September 19th, 2005, two British soldiers in wigs and dressed as members of the Shiite Mahdi army fired on Iraqi police, killing one and injuring another. After a car chase, they were arrested and taken into custody. According to Sheikh Hassan al-Zarqani, a spokesman for the Mahdi army, what our police found in their car was very disturbing. Weapons, explosives, and a remote control detonator. But the Brits from the Special Reconnaissance Regiment didn't stay in custody for long. Sources in the Iraqi Interior Ministry said that six Allied tanks were used to smash a wall in police headquarters to rescue the pair. This touched off a riot, causing Iraqis to lob Molotov cocktails at the armored vehicles. You could have heard all about this incident if you scoured the papers, albeit with a heavy pro-British spin. So why do I mention it on a commentary called What They Don't Tell You? Well, first off, most Americans haven't heard about it. Or if they did, the story was overpowered by dissembling and dramatic photos of a flaming soldier jumping from a tank. Rest assured, however, the Iraqis haven't forgotten this story. Many have suspected foreign occupiers of perpetrating quote-unquote insurgent bombings all along. More recently, a somewhat dubious Russian news site, MirrorWorld.ru, reports that a number of Iraqis caught two Americans in Arab dress trying to detonate a car bomb. The Americans were then said to have been whisked away by, quote, Iraqi puppet police, unquote. Given what happened in Basra, does anyone out there still believe that this whole adventure is to give Iraqis their freedom? Some freedom. Freedom to install Western-approved government puppets, but not the sovereignty of incarcerating two men who fire on your elected government's own police force while packing high-tech explosives in their car. Something to think about. I'm Jody Paulson, and I just thought you should know.
To listen to archive editions of What They Don't Tell You, go to radio.indymedia.org or www.radioforall.net.